Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Filmcast, a podcast about movies. I'm David Chen, and actually, I'm not David Chen. I'm just David Chen's head on top of Gal Gadot's body. Joining me today is Devendra Hardwar.
These gods sure are furious, if you know what I mean.
Okay. Those are, of course, vague and oblique references to the fact that today on the podcast, we're going to be reviewing Shazam, Fury of the Gods. Now, I know what many of you are thinking. Hey, where's Jeff Cannata? Well, Jeff Cannata couldn't be here today due to scheduling reasons, but he is going to be part of our Shazam Fury of the Gods review. So you can look forward to that. We actually were able to record that early, deliver that early for patrons on our Patreon page at patreon.com/filmpodcast, where you can get other bonuses, including early access to episodes occasionally, as well as ad-free episodes and exclusive After Darks. And boy, if everything goes according to plan, Devendra, this week we got a really nice, sweet After Dark for folks.
Should be fun. Yeah.
Should be fun if it happens, but you know, I like to half jinx it. I don't say what it is, but I do say I'm excited about it. Anyway, patreon.com/filmpodcast. Today we got some what we've been watching for you, some weekly plugs, and then of course we're going to conclude with our in-depth review of Shazam Fury of the Gods, but also got a few odds and ends, assorted emails and news items that we want to discuss. So let's get into it. You can find more episodes of this podcast at thefilmcast.com. Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Find us on YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, at thefilmcastpod. Find us on TikTok, at thefilmcast, where we upload new videos every week. Okay. Few pieces of news, few people who have passed away recently, Devendra, that I wanted to mention. A couple weeks ago, Tom Sizemore passed away. And we didn't talk about it on the podcast.
Yeah. The news just kind of recently dropped is the thing. Like, confusing. Yeah.
But also Lance Reddick passed away. So let's talk about the Lance Reddick one really hit me hard.
It blew me away because it's so, so surprising and so sad. Yeah.
I mean, the guy was 60 years old.
Mm-hmm.
He looked completely jacked every single time. Every role you see, every time you see him in real life, you're like, that is one of the healthiest people I've ever seen, you know? And he was out promoting his appearance in John Wick Chapter 4, you know? So anyway, let's talk about Lance Reddick first. Then we'll talk about Tom Sizemore. But Lance Reddick, I just want to say, you know, I have loved his roles, his performances in video games. Mm-hmm. Quite frequently, he was Silence in the Horizon video games. He was Zavala in the Destiny video games. He was a geek. You know, he loved games. He loved talking about games and playing games. And
love it.
That was amazing, you know. But in addition to that, obviously, he played many roles on TV and on the big screen. He is going to be in John Wick Chapter 4. And he's awesome in those movies, right? Like, it's a fundamentally ridiculous role. He plays Charon, the guy who is in charge of the Continental, or not
like the concierge.
The concierge at the Continental, the front desk person, right? And you know, it's the whole construct is like really out there and outlandish, but like he leans in
and something we don't talk about enough is that this guy is hilarious too. Like, he was hilarious. He never shied away from doing like really zany comedy stuff. The Funnier I Die Toys Are Me short is something that lives rent-free in my head.
Because he was on the Eric Andre show. He did a really amazing appearance.
The LeVar Burton one on Eric Andre. But also, like, people were just sharing these little tidbits. Like, there was something from so many like late-night shows. The one that really gets me, too, is Corporate. We both loved Corporate.
He was so
good because that role really... It used both his sense of like what do you call it, like leadership. Like, he's always a very stoic guy, but then he can be really silly at the same time. I think that show just balanced it perfectly. He was so good in Corporate.
Yeah. But the role that I will always remember him for is as Lieutenant Daniels in The Wire.
Sure.
That's like my first exposure to him, and he was great in that show. I mean, he was always someone who tried to do the right thing. He always stood for justice in an unjust system. And He brought so much gravitas to that role. He was like, he was kind of in some ways the moral center of that show. I know McNulty is theoretically the moral center, but he's also, McNulty was like a terrible person, you know?
Yeah.
Lieutenant Daniels.
He was
like,
the rock, and McNulty was the one trying to find his way. Yeah.
And so that is the role that will be indelible for me. So
have you seen any Bosch?
No, I haven't.
Because he's very good in Bosch.
Yeah, I've heard he's great.
Kind of playing the same role, but he is even more like stereotypical police chief shouting, "Bosch, what are you doing? That's not that's not ethical." And he really has fun with it too. So, man, this one hurts.
Yeah,
this one feels like he's had such a he would have had such a huge career ahead of him.
Yes.
This feels to me on the level of like Gandolfini or Philip Seymour Hoffman. It just I'm still like reeling from this loss.
Yeah, totally. A lot of people also brought up his performance as Philip Broyles in Fringe. I don't know how big of a Fringe fan you were, Devendra.
I'm a big Fringe fan. Yeah, he was great. He was in Lost. He like everything we all kind of love. Like he will pop up somewhere and just be awesome. The thing I was thinking of, there's a comedy Bang Bang skit with him in like this weird Tron universe and he just like leans into it to the silliness of it all, man.
Yeah,
this sucks.
I agree this one hit really hard and I'm still in shock about it as well. But yeah, Tom Sizemore passed away recently as well, and he's another actor who I want to talk about because there was a time in the 90s, Devendra, whenever there was any action movie that had dudes being dudes, Tom Sizemore would be in it.
Sure. If you needed a dude who could scare you with a look, you would cast Tom Sizemore. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my favorite Tom Sizemore moment, I'm probably going to make like a TikTok about this, is in Heat. I don't know if you remember Heat.
Yes. They're like in the diner.
They're in the diner. Right. Yep. And then, like, I think it's Wayne Grove is like, he's like, you know, the people are like upset about Wayne Grove because Wayne Grove did some dumb stuff during the high. And then, like, an argument begins, and then this guy next in the booth next to them looks like he might start to intervene.
Yeah.
And then Tom Sizemore just gives him the look, doesn't even say anything, just like looks at him in a certain way.
I dare you to interrupt us right now.
Please give me an excuse. Give me an excuse. I mean, he played, you know, he was awesome in Heat. He was awesome in Saving Private Ryan. I think he's the one that says the title of Saving Private Ryan, if I'm not mistaken, right?
They have like the conversation at the end of the movie, right? And he's the one like bringing up like, do we let him stay or do we bring him?
Yeah. Maybe Saving Private Ryan is the best, you know. Black Hawk Down, Pearl Harbor, Bringing Out the Dead, which we've talked about on the Filmcast After Dark.
Mm-hmm.
So many amazing films. And he's just kind of like, this is the guy you don't want to mess with. You know, this is the guy who you don't want to mess with. Who's like a bit messy. And
I guess that was his life too. And it's sad. Like he struggled with drug addiction. Like there was an abuse thing as well around him. Like it was a rough life for this guy. And I don't know. We enjoyed him in the 90s at least.
Yeah. He was convicted of domestic violence against his girlfriend in 2003. Yeah. You're referring to. Yeah.
It was Heidi Fleiss. Yeah. That was a whole big story back then. Yeah.
Yeah. But agreed. He definitely had his demons, but I think like for me in my like mental headspace in my cinematic upbringing, he occupied a really special place. You know,
if you ever want to like feel tough in a setting, you think to yourself, bring out your inner Tom Sizemore to hold your own. I guess
he was kind of this vision of masculinity, which was very frequently toxic. You know, but still like a vision of masculinity and. And I did really appreciate that he kind of embodied it in some ways.
He was in so many bangers in the 90s, like Point Break. There was an uncredited role I see, but Enemy of the State. We don't talk about that movie enough. It rules.
I love it.
Devil in the Blue Dress. Yeah, good stuff.
Yeah. So anyway, and he was I think 61 years old when he passed away in early March, and Lance Reddick was 60, you know, so these are both actors who feel like they, you know, they could have had decades longer ahead of them in terms of their careers. It's sad that they were taken so young, but wanted to acknowledge them as we record today. Okay, what else is there to discuss? You know, Devendra, before we get to what we've been watching, here's a little bonus topic. All right, so last week we talked about was the Oscars like a week ago, right? Like it was basically like a week ago.
Sure, it was a week ago, but it feels like a month ago.
It feels like
because you know, of the way time moves.
Three lifetimes have passed since since the Oscars. I don't know if you saw Ashley Graham interview Hugh Grant on the red carpet.
I saw bits of this, yeah.
Yeah, I just think it's worth just mentioning real quick before we get to what we've been watching, because I think it is a little bit interesting. Let's play a clip from the red carpet interview that Ashley Graham did with Hugh Grant. This is the before the ceremony began.
What are you most excited to see tonight?
To see?
Yeah, well, I know that you probably watched a few of the movies. Are you excited to see anybody win? Do you have your hopes up for anyone?
No one in particular.
Okay, well, what are you wearing tonight then?
Just my suit.
Your suit? Who made your suit? You didn't make it.
I can't remember. My tailor.
That's okay. Yeah. Shout out to the tailor. Yeah. So tell me, what does it feel like to be in Glass Onion? It was such an amazing film. I really loved it. I love a thriller. How fun is it to shoot something like that?
Well, I'm barely in it. I'm in it for about 3 seconds.
Yeah, but still, you showed up and you had fun, right?
Almost.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, thank you so much. It was nice to talk to you.
Yeah.
All right. Back to you guys.
That's actually not, it actually was in some parts worse than that. I think Vanity Fair, like earlier on, she references, he references, it's like Vanity Fair. And then she thinks he's talking about the party.
The magazine, the publication, because they're at the Oscars. Yeah.
That's when the interview is over basically at that point. But this is brutal to listen to because Devendra, you and I, we've both been there.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
We've both been there where
you know when you've lost the person, you know it. And I remember for me, the first thing when I lost somebody was Matthew Vaughn at the first Comic-Con I went to with us. And it's just kind of a dick. I was like, okay. I mean, thank you, Matthew Vaughn, for talking to me about Kick-Ass. But yeah, it happens.
Yeah, it happens where, like, what we're describing is Devendra and I have both interviewed many people during our illustrious careers online, and sometimes you get an interviewee who just does not want to be there, right?
Yeah.
And I have great sympathy for them. You know,
it's a tiring process.
It's a tiring process because they're talking to, like, 15 people in one day. It's the same questions over and over again. They need to seem excited all the time. So I'm not of the opinion that, like, you know, how dare Hugh Grant, like, this is his job to look good and blah, 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 you know, because it's hard for them to, who knows what the process was to get him on that mic. Maybe some producer grabbed him physically. And
that's
was like,
because they're walking down the carpet, right?
Yeah. And was like, hey, Hugh Grant, come do an interview. And he's like, I really don't want to. And they're like, come on, it's just 60 seconds.
I would love to see the pre-interview.
Right. Exactly. And so it's hard for, it's basically a terrible system that both, interviewer and interviewee are trapped in. I have sympathy for them both.
Yeah.
But it does suck when you have a mismatch, not only culturally, but also like of what we're trying to do. You know, Ashley Graham's there. She's like, hey, I'm here to provide some fluffy, inconsequential.
He is not throwing her any bones.
He's giving her nothing. He's giving her nothing.
And he knows what he's doing too. Like, I feel like the part of it, like, sometimes people like to have fun with you because, like, oh, look at you, little interview troll. Like, oh, I'm just gonna poke fun of you. I think the Vanity Fair thing showed like he was basically, it was very demeaning what he was doing to the interviewer as well. Like, it's very snobbish. It's a whole thing. Like this brings to mind, like, there was the reports about Hugh Grant on the set of Dungeons and Dragons, right? Mm. That he had a huge tantrum against somebody who he says he thought it was like an executive or somebody working, I don't know, related to the film, but it turns out it was a nice local woman, he says. But who cares? Maybe just don't have these weird freakouts. And there have been reports of this a lot around him on set. So it's like, man, I don't know about Hugh Grant.
Yeah, okay. So he says, I did a Christian Bale, he said to Total Film Magazine on the set of Dungeons & Dragons, according to him. Where he says, quote, I lost my temper with a woman in my eyeline. I assumed she was some executive from the studio who should have known better. Mm-hmm. Then it turns out she's an extremely nice local woman who is the chaperone of the young girl. Terrible. A lot of groveling. And
she ruined his eyeline on Dungeons & Dragons. How dare she?
Yeah, yeah. So you're definitely on Ashley Graham's side on this one.
No, I mean, most definitely. Like, also, but this whole interview just sounds like, yeah, I've dealt with people like this. And sometimes I like to have fun with them, too. It's like, oh, this is what you're giving me? Okay, I'm going to swing something back to you. I'm reminded of when there was a CES where I was lucky enough to, like, chat with what's his face? John McAfee. And that interview was terrifying because this was John McAfee. By that point, we knew kind of a wild guy. He was the guy who was like on the run in South America, basically evading the law in some countries, may or may not have killed a neighbor, like a whole crazy, like part of like a big drug running thing. He was like promoting a startup.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he was there. He's like, also, I'm going to talk about my run for presidency, too. So this must have been like 2016. And it was just a lot of me being like, why are you like vetting? Like, what are you talking about with this company? Why do you want to run for president? It's a lot of me just really pushing back on him. And he kept pushing back on me. And he's a very angry looking man. You don't want that's like Tom Sizemore eyes, you know, looking at you.
Good callback. Good callback.
Shaking his hand, I felt like, oh, I don't know what I'm dealing with here. So I left there really quickly after that interview. But it does happen, and I do not feel much sympathy for Hugh Grant here.
Indeed. Since we're sharing bad interview stories, I think I'll say in an interview like that, it's in an interview like the Hugh Grant interview or even the John McAfee
interview. It's live. You can't run away from it.
You can't run away. Man. I mean, like, it's actually not that bad because those kinds of interviews are so bad.
Mm-hmm. Nobody expects much.
Well, they go viral. They go viral. And it's like, it becomes a story in and of itself, which is like kind of interesting. You know, like people have taken sides. You know, some people are like pro Ashley Graham. Some people are pro Hugh Grant on this whole situation, like, you know, in this whole situation. And so I think Hugh Grant, in my opinion, both Hugh Grant and Ashley Graham will both get some notoriety as a result of this interview.
Therefore, it's a whole like life philosophy thing for me. Yeah.
But Devendra, here's what I'm going to say. I think that the even worse interview is ones that are like the person is barely there. It's not even like they're like Hugh Grant, I think, is like almost trying to be terrible in that interview. Right.
Oh, absolutely.
But the worst is like, I think I once interviewed Sam Rockwell. I don't remember if it was it for Confessions of the Year? I don't even remember what movie it was. Yeah. Maybe it was for Iron Man 2. It was probably for Iron Man 2. I once interviewed Sam Rockwell, and he literally sounded like he had just woken up.
That happens all the time.
It was a phone interview, which are like, in my opinion, really bad. Like, I try not to do phone interviews these days. At least now we have Zoom, at least, so you can like see the person.
You can confirm they're awake.
But yeah, it sounded like he just woken up.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, oh, you know, he's barely showing up. You know, so those are the worst because this is not. I'm not even going to get a viral moment out of this. This is just like a waste of both of our time.
It's just,
you know,
nothing. That happened to me. You know, shout out to John Cho. I love John Cho, but I did an in-person interview with him in New York, and he absolutely showed up an hour late. Clearly, just jumped out of bed. Like, clearly just jumped out of bed. Yeah, I was like, okay, I mean, it doesn't matter, really, but at least he gave me a good interview, you know? Yeah, like, everybody's late sometimes.
Yeah, well, the worst is when they jump out of bed and then they're just like, there's nothing, you know, they sound tired. They sound like they haven't had their coffee yet. And again, my sympathy is, I'm not saying, hey, how dare these people not give me good answers? I don't feel that way. I feel like, wow,
we're just trying to have a conversation, man.
This is a bad system. Yeah. This is the system has failed us both.
I'm trying to promote the thing you are in. I'm trying to help you.
Exactly right. So anyway,
man,
Ashley Graham, she seems to have taken it quite well. I hope she's doing okay with it. But I thought it was an interesting viral moment that we both have had some level of experience with as well.
It's
not
rough
on a national stage in front of millions of people. So
I feel like that whole thing, like being on the Oscars live feed, is just terrifying because any mistake will go viral. Hopefully it's not your fault. And I don't really think this was much her fault.
Indeed. All right. Well, those are a few pieces of film news this week. We're going to take a break. We're going to talk about a sponsor and we'll be right back with what we've been watching. Stick around.
Hey, I just want to jump in here and tell you about our sponsor, FastGrowingTrees.com. Breathe some life into your own backyard with FastGrowingTrees.com this spring. That's what I did. That's what I'm doing right now. I'm using FastGrowingTrees.com to add some life. From shade to fresh fruit to privacy and natural beauty, you can let FastGrowingTrees.com help you plant your dream garden with their expert advice and fast, reliable shipping. Now, I say I did it. I handed this over to my wife. I said, check out fastgrowingtrees.com. She loves making things beautiful in our yard. And also, she loves adding a little extra privacy, like I said. Fastgrowingtrees.com's plant experts Well, they curate thousands of easy-to-grow plant, shrub, and tree varieties for your unique climate. Meyer lemons to evergreens to everything in between. Now, this is key to why I referred my wife to this site, because we're new to Colorado. We don't know this environment. We don't know what grows here. They've got those plant experts to make sure we're getting what's going to live, what's going to thrive in our yard. Happy plants, happy home, right? Sometimes it's hard to know which plants will do the best. Well, that's why you go to fastgrowingtrees.com, because you get those customized recommendations based on your specific needs. Plus, as I said, their plant experts are always available to help keep your plants growing healthy through the season and beyond. No more waiting in long lines, hauling heavy plants around. With fastgrowingtrees.com, you order online. It's so easy, and your plants arrive at your door in just a few days. We did it. We've already added to our yard. It's awesome and so, so easy. And with Fast Growing Trees' 30-day Alive and Thrive guarantee, you know everything will look great fresh out of the box. Join over 1.5 million happy Fast Growing Trees customers. Go to fastgrowingtrees.com/filmcast right now to get 15% off your entire order. That's 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com/filmcast.
All right, Devendra, let's start with you this week. What have you been watching this week?
Sure. I got to check out the first few episodes of Swarm, the new Donald Glover series co-created by Janine Neighbors. It's on Amazon Prime. And the show is wild. And I'm really digging it. It starts.
Yeah, Dominic Fishback. So let's say we are going to give away the premise for Swarm.
Yes. I won't spoil many of the things in the first episode.
If Jeff Cannata were here, he would say that, hey, this is a show where you got to go in completely cold. It's so surprising. You have an amazing experience if you don't know anything about it. Okay,
It's hard to go in cold because everyone's talking about it.
We are going to give away the premise. So if you don't want to know the premise of Swarm, streaming right now on Prime Video, skip forward by a couple minutes, but yes, it is a show where if you don't know anything about it, it is shocking. So here comes the premise. But anyway, Devendra, go ahead. What were you going to say?
Sure. Here's the premise. Dominic Fishback stars as Dre. She is a girl who is very, very into a pop star called Nyjah. She's a super fan. You know, she basically co-runs a Twitter account from a super fan account. Her life kind of goes off the rails in the first episode. Like, things go bad for her, and she ends up traveling around the country murdering people left and right. Like,
who don't like Nyjah, basically.
Who don't like Nyjah or have, like, done her sister wrong, too. Like, that's a whole thing. Chloe Bailey plays her sister. This is a very strange show. Somebody had tweeted, it is wild that Poker Face, which is about a lady going around the country, driving around the country to solve murders
versus like, this is a reverse Poker Face. It's a woman going around committing murders, basically.
Committing murders. And it is meant to be an exploration of fandom and dark fandom. And Dre as a character also seems like somebody who is, you know, stuck, like, developmentally. She has a lot of arrested development in that she doesn't seem like fully an adult when we meet her. And her life just, like, gets increasingly crazy. But the show kind of turns into a sort of, like, Dexter type of thing, too. Like, I hear it really does coalesce towards the end around what it's trying to say around fandom. Three episodes in, it just feels like she's going on different adventures every episode. But it feels like an extended Atlanta episode. And it has that, like,
it really does. Yeah. And Donald Glover directed some of the episodes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I agree. It definitely feels like Atlanta. And we should say that, like, it was inspired. Mm-hmm. Apparently the show Swarm on Prime Video was inspired by two things. Number one, there was a fake story, but, like, people didn't know it was fake at the time, that somebody, like, Nyjah in the show Swarm is heavily inspired by Beyoncé.
Yeah, basically.
And the show actually begins every episode by saying, this is not a work of fiction. Any resemblance to actual people is intentional. It's very funny. But it's heavily inspired by Beyoncé. Like, there's very similar albums and events in both Nyjah and Beyoncé's life that are analogs. But apparently Swarm was inspired by two separate things. Number one, a fake story that came out that a woman had killed herself after listening to Lemonade.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of like, wow, the fandom was so strong and they were so upset by that album that they offed themselves. And secondarily, like a comment about like a tweet mm-hmm. about how there's very few black women serial killers on screen. Like, why is it that black women always have to be, you know, psychiatrists or yeah. the best
we
friend
need
or
equality
whatever.
In all things.
Yeah. Yes. Black women can be serial killers too. And so, this show kind of takes both of those ideas and runs with them.
Kind of love it. Like, I feel like a lot of Atlanta episodes are also based on like, I heard this tweet about this thing. Let's just make an episode about
yeah,
it. And
yeah.
generally the show does a great job with that. I'm just really having fun with this. I started watching this on my own. I think my wife will enjoy this a lot too. A lot of really interesting guest stars too, who I think are also like commenting on the celebrity industry in many ways
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
Like in the, I think it's the second episode, Paris Jackson appears. That's Michael Jackson's daughter. It's a whole thing. And the things she's commenting on, she's playing a character called Haley. There's a lot. There's a lot going on in the show. I think it's a lot of fun, but I think you have to have a good stomach, because it is like, you know, Dre is somebody who will straight up murder somebody at the drop of a hat. She does not have like a sense of, you know, it seems like a sense of empathy, really.
Yeah, it's brutal and vicious, but the thing is, the situations are so ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. It compels me though. Yeah.
Yeah. The when the violence happens, it's actually very funny to me. You know, it's mm-hmm. not like, I don't feel like, horrified by it. I'm just like, usually I'm just laughing when something like terrible
it's
happens.
Kind of funny. There's kind of a feminist bent early on too. I'm not, that doesn't always stick around, but it does feel like somebody who is kind of taking back control of her life and in situations where, you know, maybe she would have been victimized or something. So it is fascinating. That's all I'll say. Like, I don't agree with Dre. I don't support all of Dre's choices. She's not Megan, yeah. you know, but I think it is really interesting and fun to watch.
I think it's a great show. Mm-hmm. It's super provocative, and it's basically, in my opinion, a thought exercise of like,
yeah.
we have seen online, you know, actually I wanted to bring this up, Devendra. I don't know if you saw it. A.O. Scott is retiring.
I saw that. Yeah.
He's retiring from reviewing movies.
He's going
now,
back to books. He started in books.
He's going back to books. And he gave a kind of exit interview at the New York Times that I've been thinking about a lot. And here's what he says about modern fandom. He says, quote, "I'm not a fan of modern fandom. This isn't only because I've been swarmed on Twitter by angry devotees of Marvel and DC, and more recently, Top Gun Maverick and Everything Everywhere All at Once. It's more that the behavior of these social media hordes represents an anti-democratic, anti-intellectual mindset that is harmful to the cause of art and antithetical to the spirit of movies. Fan culture is rooted in conformity, obedience, group identity, and mob behavior, and its rise mirrors and models the spread of intolerant, authoritarian, aggressive tendencies in our politics and in our communal life," end quote. Been thinking about that a lot. First of all, very sad that like
mm-hmm.
people who watched Everything Everywhere All at Once felt the need to mob A.O.
Yeah.
Scott. A movie that kind of preaches understanding and love.
Absolutely. It's weird. I have heard reports of this. I have not seen this behavior among people, but I'm sure it's happened
I've
to some people.
I've seen glimpses of it. I've seen I've seen enough to know that it's real. You know,
mm-hmm.
like I've seen like it's intense out there. People feel strongly that these movies represent part of who they are, and if you
sure.
don't like them, you don't like them. And that is the dynamic that we see in TV shows like Swarm, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where and what Swarm asks is, a lot of these people evince obviously like if you looked at it from the outside, it looks like psychotic behavior online.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and the question that is asked by the show Swarm is, what if it actually was psychotic? Right? Like,
let's just take it to its logical
right,
conclusion.
But what if it
guess,
actually
yeah.
like people are doxing people who don't like, you didn't like God of War, so let's dox you? Like, that is
mm-hmm.
that is terrifying behavior. Like, what if we actually made the behavior more extreme that swarm. And it's fascinating because in some ways it holds a mirror up to modern fandom. And I think it's a good thing to look at. Yeah, it's a good thing to see.
I cannot wait to see like where it goes, because I think the conclusion is really going to seal the deal on the show for me. But I have to say, it is also coming at a weird time. Dave, I'm sure you saw that story about there was a stalker of a podcaster in the Seattle area who murdering her and her husband and shooting himself. And it's a whole thing. And that is another like lens of this whole fandom thing as well. That's not new, but it is fascinating.
It's like terrifying. It's terrifying. Yeah. This podcaster got murdered by a fan no more than 20 miles away from where I'm sitting right now as I'm recording this, you know? And so they're a podcaster, and this fan got obsessed with them and then murdered her and her husband. And I think killed himself is my understanding. And it's just like,
and the person like, and tried the person, to get help.
The person
too,
did everything right.
So
the person
slow.
Did everything right. They like reported it to the cop. They kept track of everything. They reported to. They did everything right, and society could not protect this podcaster. And it's like, wow, like, yeah. It's a really scary world out there. You know, I ask myself like, what would I have done in that situation? Mm-hmm. I don't know, but like clearly, what this person does, which is they did everything right, that wasn't enough. Anyway, okay, upsetting story. Yep. To think about, but these are the thoughts that are stirred up when you watch Swarm on Prime Video, which again I agree, I think it's really worth checking out. It's really good. So
have you seen the latest season of Atlanta?
No, I haven't. I dropped off halfway through season 3. I heard season 4 is awesome.
Yeah.
So like
I want to
get back to season 4 and like do finally finish that show.
Mm-hmm. This show just reminds me of what I love so much about Atlanta, right? It's funny and irreverent and says things.
It's like absurdist. It's like absurdist. It's really well made. Compositionally it's beautiful, but season 3 really lost me, I have to say.
It was fun, but it was like a departure for them, and they're basically back in America now, so it all kind of works better.
I've heard season 4 is a masterpiece. I can't wait to get back to Atlanta. Anyway, Swarm on Prime Video. That's what Devinder Hardawar has been watching this week. Okay, I watched a few things. I'll talk about a couple of them. Let's talk about the bad one first. let's do a what we've been watching sandwich, where you get a good thing, a bad thing, and a good thing.
Sure.
Okay? So I watched a documentary that is at the top of the TV charts. It's called MH370, The Flight That Disappeared. Have you heard of this?
I have not heard of this, but apparently it's very popular.
It's like one of the top five shows on Netflix for the last couple weeks.
Okay, man. Yeah. Like the Netflix stuff, you could make up a TV show, right? And just tell me, this is the most popular thing on Netflix right now. All I could do is nod. Like, sure. Mm-hmm, yeah, I've never, literally never heard of that in my life, but millions of people have seen it. Sure.
Yeah. Malaysia Flight 370, vanished. It is one of the only flights that vanished, where it just like kind of vanished off the face of the earth, and for a long time people didn't know what happened to it. This was in March of 2014.
Yep.
And this is a three-part documentary that tries to illustrate, or tries to answer the question, "What happened?" by putting forward several theories about what might have happened. Now, look, Devendra, here on the Filmcast, I try to be kind to movies, especially to documentaries.
It's a miracle when anything is made. Yeah,
it's a miracle when anything's made. It's impressive when anything's made, especially documentaries, which until very recently, you know, were like, these were passion projects. Like, no one's getting rich off documentaries.
They required work. We all went to the theater to see Murder Ball. Yeah. It was great.
Years of work. Yes, exactly. Wow, Devendra, nice callback. I went to a theater to go see Murder Ball. That is correct.
I went to the tiny Northampton Arts Theater to see Murder Ball.
That is a thing that I did, yeah. So, making documentaries, you know, like, it's hard to make any movies. It's really hard to make documentaries because there's less money in it in general. So I try not to slag off any documentaries or any movies in general. Like, people have asked about like my Letterboxd ratings. I always start every Letterboxd rating at 2.5 stars.
Sure.
No matter how bad it is. Because it's like, you got a movie complete. You made a movie. So it's like, you 2.5 stars just for accomplishing that. And then I may add or subtract depending on like how good or bad it is. But this is a documentary that I have to say is maddening. It is maddening, and I would argue borderline irresponsible.
Man.
Because in my opinion, what this documentary does is it presents a lot of different theories, many of which are conspiracy theories about what might have happened here. And then it will show like one person saying like, maybe the Russians hijacked it. Maybe this happened. And then it will have another person saying, yeah, I don't really think that's true. And like, that's how the movie or the show, the documentary handles truth. And it's like, no, this is really bad. Like, if you as the documentarian think that person is full of shit, you should present the facts in a way to make that clear. But the documentary does not do that. There's many people who watch this and they are less clear on what happened than before they watched the documentary.
Does this one do the reenactments and stuff too? Or is it
does reenactments of every theory, no matter how ridiculous. That's the thing. Is like when you do the reenactment, people are like, oh yeah, that could have happened, despite how implausible the actual reenactment might have been.
I feel like this is the logical end of like the criticisms around Errol Morris too, right? When people were like, the line between, you know, dramatization and accuracy and truth telling like seems to be getting a little blurred here in the pursuit of making a good show.
I think that's fair, but I think in Errol Morris's movies, it's very rare that you don't know what Errol Morris's position on the facts are.
Yeah.
It's very rare.
He's usually grounded in truth as much as he can find. Yeah.
Yeah. He presents it in such a way that if somebody is saying bullshit, it's like very obvious that person's full of shit. Like it'll be like, he'll present someone saying some stupid thing. And then he'll say like, here's five experts definitively debunking like why that person said that, you know, like
except when he made those Theranos ads, not his brightest day, not his finest hour.
Okay, but to be fair, those were supposed to be documentaries. But yes,
I know. It's just like this is what we're criticizing, man.
Fair enough. But anyway, this if you are hoping to get a better understanding of what happened to Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. Do not watch this documentary. It reminded me of Steve Bannon's approach to media, which is flood the zone with shit. Like,
there's
just like a bunch of stuff in here that's like completely nonsensical, and it presents virtually everyone as credible. That's the problem. That's my big problem. Is like,
this is a made for Netflix documentary, right?
Yeah, it's like maybe this person's right. Maybe this person's right. You know what it reminded me of? Did you ever see Room 237?
So did not like it.
Okay,
to be honest,
I loved Room 237, but it basically takes the Room 237 approach to present. So Room 237, for those who don't know, is about Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, and it basically has, I think, five or six people doing voiceover on scenes from The Shining, talking about their wild theories about what happened in The Shining. Like that's what the whole movie is.
That's the whole thing. Yeah.
And at the end of the day, the movie basically takes no position on like who's right, who's wrong, what's valid, what's not valid.
At the end of the day, I'm left asking, so what? Why did I do this? Why did I watch any of this?
That is fine for a movie like Room 237, where the stakes are, hey, are you a respected film critic on Twitter? You know, like it is not okay when there's people who've actually had loved ones vanish or die on this flight. This is a thing. Like, I can't imagine being somebody who lost someone in flight 237 or flight 370 watching this documentary and just watching this utter nonsense be reenacted and giving airtime. It's kind of unconscionable. So
I feel like the Netflix documentaries in general like have not been very strong, right? If it's made for Netflix, then maybe I don't know the story here, but it seems like sometimes people are contracted to make a thing, like they pitch a thing.
Yeah.
Netflix funds it from the beginning, and it feels like an incomplete book report. I've kind of encountered this in a lot of Netflix documentaries where it feels like they're diluting the art form, basically. But it's feel like I could have seen this on YouTube.
They are hit or miss. There's a wide spectrum of quality. And I think I talked recently about a piece in Vulture about how Netflix has completely transformed the documentary space and how, you know, it's not too long ago, 10, 15 years ago, there was not a thing where like 50 million people watched a documentary. Like that was just never a thing that ever happened. Right. And so now there's like money, there's eyes in it. And the industry is trying to catch up. It's trying to catch up with this money, this interest. And so as a result, you might have a few things that are a little bit weaker. I thought MH370, The Flight That Disappeared, was a little bit weaker. One of the weaker ones. And I thought it was kind of irresponsible, and that's why I'm spending a lot of time saying you should watch.
Do not watch.
Yeah.
And is there a good one? Like, we don't actually know what happened, right? It's all conjecture at this point.
I do think that there's one thing that MH370 does, the documentary does do well, which is you get to hear from the families of the people who have disappeared. Like that, mm-hmm. that is very valuable, and that is the one redeeming factor of this that makes it not a complete waste of time. Yeah, I didn't like it at all, and I wouldn't recommend it. And I'm going to have to do some research into what I actually would recommend, but, like, this ain't it. This mm-hmm. ain't it. So, okay. So that's MH370, The Flight That Disappeared on Netflix. Did not like it. I also had a chance to watch Accident Man, Hitman's Holiday, or it's the sequel to Accident Man 1.
Yeah.
Now, why did I watch Accident Man... Hitman's Holiday. Do you know why I watched this movie?
Scott Adkins, baby. Yeah.
It's because on a recent episode of the Filmcast After Dark, we discussed Vulture Stunt Awards.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the awards went to one of the awards was Best Fight, which is awarded to a hand-to-hand combat sequence that does not involve guns, though it can involve other weapons. The nominees were Accident Man, Hitman's Holiday, Everything Everywhere All at Once, Lost Bullet 2, RRR or Prey. And the winner was Accident Man, Hitman's Holiday. Now, I have now watched Accident Man, Hitman's Holiday.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, I don't agree that should have won. I mean, I think literally, like, RRR, the opening fight scene with Ram, like, going up against all those guys. The fanny pack fight scene, you know, Prey's final fight scene. Yeah. Like, all those were...
I've seen Lost Bullet. That is a pretty great fight scene, too. Yeah.
So I like those other fight scenes better, but this is still a really good fight scene. And Accident Man, Hitman's Holiday is basically, it's not a good movie, in my opinion. It is more of a fight scene delivery mechanism than it is a movie.
Which is what Scott Adkins movies tend to be known for, like his direct-to video stuff. So, yeah, sure. It's fine.
I mean, what do you know about Scott Adkins? I've heard a lot about Scott Adkins, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen very many of his movies.
Oh, really?
Okay. But I've heard he's in John Wick Chapter 4 and he's great in it.
In John Wick Chapter 4. It kind of started with a Universal Soldier movie. I believe it was Universal Soldier Day of Reckoning, where people started paying attention to this guy. And that was directed by John Hyams. I don't know how you pronounce that. But
I think was he also the guy that got the, he was also in the Bourne Ultimatum. But I guess, I don't know if he was, a big character in that. He was Agent Kylie in the Bourne Ultimatum.
I don't remember which one he was in Ultimatum, but yeah, he has basically been in a lot of these things and, you know, been a lot of like really good direct to video stuff, like Hard Target 2. There's a Hard Target 2.
I see.
You know?
Well, I think he's awesome. Like, I think he will, I don't think he's a household name yet. But I think he will be one day. You know what I'm saying?
Action fans, I feel like, so he's kind of been on the verge for a decade. And that's why I'm like, are you relegated to just being the action fan, you know, guy? Or will you ever hit mainstream? Physically, I've seen a lot of his fight scenes. He's also in this movie, Avengement. He starred in that.
I heard Avengement's great. I'm going to try to check that movie out too. But yeah, I mean, he is really talented. He's really good looking.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I feel like this guy's day is coming anytime soon. And maybe John Wick Chapter, maybe we're going to look back on this moment that we're recording this podcast, mm-hmm. Devendra, as the pre Scott Adkins breaking out in a massive.
His role as Killa in John Wick Chapter 4.
Maybe he's huge. Neither Devendra or I have seen John Wick Chapter 4. So like, maybe he is huge in that. But mm-hmm. anyway, you know, the Accident Man, Hitman's Holiday, like, it's called Accident... I haven't seen Accident Man 1, but my understanding is he's called Accident Man because he stages these elaborate accidents
to
kill people.
He is like the guy in the Hitman games.
Yes, he always has to do that. He's Agent 47 from the Hitman games, right? But the story in Accident Man, Hitman's Holiday is about as good as a story in, like, a Street Fighter video game, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's not
so
like
excellent.
It's
okay.
Not, it's, or Tekken, you know, like it's how good a story is in Tekken. But there are, I don't know, 6-7 great hand-to-hand fight sequences.
Hell yeah!
In this movie.
I mean, I'm thinking back to the glory days of like Hong Kong action. The plots and stories in a lot of those movies do not really hold up.
Correct.
But what
Correct.
You get is some sick ass fight scenes, and I'm totally fine with that.
And there are some really great fight scenes. You know, some of them aren't great, but it's like, hey, I trust that you're watching two actual people do this thing. And it's what's special is that you know that it's actually Scott Adkins doing it. You know, like it's not so. Maybe he had a stunt double, but for a lot of the scenes, it looks like it's actually him.
I mean, yeah, he is a guy who basically started as like a stunt guy too. Like, so he's been doing this for a while.
A lot of it is shot very respectfully. What I mean by that is it's shot in such a way to highlight how much work went into these stunts. And the fight scene that did win is a really solid fight. Like, my wife and I were watching the movie together, and we're like, I was like, yeah, I know this movie got best fight, but I don't know which fight it was. And then when the fight started, we're like, oh, it's this one. Like,
this is
the one that's the good one, right? Like, there is one fight that is like better than all the other ones, and that's the one that won best fight. It's very good. If you want some fun, ridiculous, over the top plotting and fight scenes, I think you could do a lot worse than Accident Man and Hitman's Holiday. By the way, the movie is streaming right now on Hulu. And I think Scott Adkins, if he's not going to become a household name soon, he should be. Like, he is.
There's a lot of stuff to catch up on with him, but yeah.
He is, you know, he has it. He has the goods, in my opinion. So, and I hope he finds movies that are worthy of his talent. So I'm really impressed by him.
It's getting rough too, because like, I feel like I've been waiting for him to really take off since like 2012, you know, like since the early 2010s. And these guys are getting older, man. It just kind of stinks. Like, between him and Donnie Yen, Donnie Yen's also in John Wick 4. And it's like, man, I want Donnie Yen to at least have a big American hit at some point, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, dude, he was in Rogue One. Okay. So
yeah.
You know, that was a pretty big deal.
That was pretty big.
And he was great in that movie too. So anyway,
I feel like that character deserved more. He seems like he's playing a much more central role in John Wick 4. So
well,
I'm down with that.
I think that, you know, Devendra, you and I are shaped by our experience in the 80s and 90s, where it was like the dream of every like Hong Kong action star to break into America, to break into the American film industry. So you have like John Woo and Jackie Chan, like making it big in the United States.
Chow Yun Fat did a couple. Yeah.
You know, Chow Yun Fat. But it just seems like that is just not really a thing anymore. It seems like that's for a variety of reasons. Number one, China's film industry is huge now. It was not back in the day, or it was not at the same level. Like, American movies did huge business in China in the 90s and aughts. And now China barely will let these movies in, you know, like things have changed a lot, and I think like the idea of like, oh, Donnie Yen having like a big career in the U.S. I don't know. I mean,
I would like to see. I don't think his career depends on it.
The counterpoint to what I just said is Michelle Yeoh,
who
appeared in Crazy Rich Asians in 2018.
She is a lead character in the Star Trek show.
Right,
lead character in Star Trek show.
But you know, basically, I'm saying, I don't know what Jackie Chan and Donnie Yen and John Woo even really want right now. You know, I don't know if they want to like make it big in the U.S. film industry anymore. Like, maybe they have other priorities.
I'm not saying they need to, but I would love for Donnie Yen to be a household name, just for like the big talents. Like, I feel like a lot of people know who Jet Li is, and Jet Li had that moment. It kind of worked out well for him.
That's another great example. Yeah, Jet Li. Yeah. So, okay. Well, anyway, those are a few things I've been watching. Let's take a break for some sponsors. We'll be back with more here on the Filmcast. All right, let's get to weekly plugs. Weekly plugs, a part of the show each week where we plug something else we've been making. I wanted to plug an interview I did with the Daniels a year ago. I interviewed the Daniels for Culturally Relevant Podcast a year ago, and I transcribed that interview. For those of you who hate, for those listeners out there who hate listening to conversations, which I know is so many people who are listening to this right now, you can now read my interview with the Daniels over on my free newsletter, absolutely free to subscribe. It's called Decoding Everything. Check it out at decodingeverything.com. It's a great interview. I think it's a great interview. A lot of Filmcast tidbits in there too.
Nice.
A lot of references to the Filmcast, because as folks know, the Daniels used to listen to the Filmcast. So check that out over at decodingeverything.com. Subscribe today. It's completely free. And I think it's one of my favorite interviews that I've ever done. Devendra Hardwar. Yeah, speaking of terrible interviews, you know, earlier, this is not that. You know, this is the opposite of that. Okay. Devinder Hardwar, what's your weekly plug?
Sure. I want to point to the latest episode of the Engadget podcast. We talked about Silicon Valley Bank and that whole disaster, which kind of just was all over the news last week. I'm not a finance guy. I'm not good with numbers. So we brought on Alex Wilhelm, editor-in-chief at TechCrunch Plus, to kind of break that down for us. It's a really good conversation. And if you are confused by all this stuff and you want to know why everybody's talking about SVB and why all these other banks are failing, you should take a listen. It's pretty informative.
Of course, I want to plug our podcast, patreon.com/filmpodcast, so you can support the show. Make sure it keeps going. We did recaps of Poker Face Season 1 and Last of Us Season 1 recently on an episode of The After Dark. And this week, we have something really special in store that I can't say what it is because I don't want to jinx it. But patreon.com/filmpodcast, where you can sign up for ad-free episodes and exclusive After Darks. Of course, we never want anyone to donate if it in any way causes you financial hardship. There's a very easy way to support us: leaving a review. Every week, tens of thousands of people listening to me speak right now, enjoy this podcast. Don't leave a review on Apple Podcasts. And I'm here to tell you, you can stop that trend today by simply going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcast. Leaving a star rating or a review, it literally takes 5 seconds. It's something you can easily do that will help us out. I hope you'll consider it. Or just share about us on social media. That would also help. All right. That's going to bring us to our review of Shazam! The Fury of the Gods, featuring Jeff Cannata.
I'm an idiot.
It's showtime!
I don't deserve these powers, if I'm being honest. Like, what am I even contributing?
Ow!
There's already a superhero with a red suit with a lightning bolt on it. Aquaman is literally huge and he's so manly. And Batman is so cool. And I'm just me. I feel like a fraud. It doesn't matter. Anyway, a wizard gave me superpowers. And then everybody got superpowers.
Where's everyone going?
To fight crime?
Welcome to the Filmcast's review of Shazam! Fury of the Gods. I'm going to read the plot summary from IMDb. The film continues the story of teenage Billy Batson, who upon reciting the magic word Shazam! Is transformed into his adult superhero alter ego, Shazam! End quote.
You said it three times, really? And now he's going to appear. So.
Really, not the most detailed plot summary there, but perhaps appropriate.
I like any summary that uses three sentences or a long, more words to say what could have been said in very, very few words. It's a movie about Shazam.
Yes.
More Shazam. Shazam. Yeah.
You get more Shazam in this Shazam.
Now, when Shazam was released in 2019, I actually was pleasantly surprised by this movie. You know,
all were. Yeah.
I have no attachment to this franchise at all. Mm-hmm. Emotionally, it's not like something I really adored growing up or anything like that. And what David Sandberg was able to deliver with a screenplay by Henry Gayden was a pretty heartfelt story of this kid, mm-hmm. Billy Batson, trying to find love and family in this world, with a fairly amusing performance by Zachary Levi and a decent villain with Mark Strong. Not, you know, pretty
Mark Strong, a villain.
Pretty standard as far as villains go, you know, but yeah. Like nothing, you know.
Literally playing Mark Strong.
Mark
again.
Strong gives
Mark
good
Strong
villain.
In Kick-Ass. You Mark know? Strong in Sherlock Holmes. Yeah. Man.
He gives good villain. And so, mm-hmm. of course, many elements of the movie prove to be irresistible. So
that's why I like seeing Mark Strong in Tar so much.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very just, not just Mark little, Strong, Mark Strong.
A
you know?
Little
dweeb. Mark Weak.
What?
Was more Mark.
Was. So anyway, at the same time that Shazam came out, did pretty well, a bunch of other DC movies came out, did pretty well. There has been chaos unfolding over at Warner Brothers. Multiple regime changes, uh-huh. And a complete reworking of what it means to be in the DCU. So it is with great apprehension that I come into this movie wondering, like, what is this movie's place in the DCU? Can it deliver a satisfying individual story, regardless of any of that?
Nobody told this movie that there was reworkings at the WB.
They're in Philadelphia. There's all this other stuff happening in the world, but they're just in Philadelphia, guys.
Yes.
It's all they're seeing.
It's very M. Night Shyamalan-esque in terms of how isolated it is for everything else happening in the world. But all that said, Devinder Hardwar, did you find this to be a worthy follow-up to 2019's Shazam?
You know what? I did. And it's weird because I think I have been seeing a lot of negative reviews for this movie. And I think you're kind of maybe cursed when you introduce something that's so new and refreshing to, I think, an increasingly stale superhero formula. And the DC stuff, we just didn't know what to expect because so much of it was like hit or miss. But I think the first Shazam was a huge surprise. It proved that David S. Sandberg could also do a big superhero movie. Also proves what we've been talking about. Horror directors make really great superhero film directors. Like that genre, the same like genre pacing, the same sort of like reveals and everything kind of work out between genres there. I think this movie has the problem that Guardians of the Galaxy 2 has, in that the first movie was so fun, such a huge surprise. And then it's like, do it again, Sam. Well, it's never going to be the same. But you know what? I do like the tune it's playing. Like, I think it is a perfectly serviceable kids superhero movie with some really fun horror elements. It's fine. I think it's perfectly fine. I really enjoyed it. I never felt bored while watching it. And I actually think this movie actually tries for something. It is emotionally grounded in a way because it's all about Billy Batson and his feelings of abandonment, you know, and his feelings of trying to have a hashtag family, losing the hashtag family. And it's really like, that's really the core of this movie. And I think that really does carry its way all the way through. Like the way characters act, the way the rest of the family and the other kids act, I think it all makes sense and they all feel like real, genuine human emotions. So yeah, I don't really care as much for Billy as a character, to be honest, but all those other kids, I kind of love them. Like they're just so much fun. And especially Jack Dylan Grazer as Freddie Freeman and his alter ego, Adam Brody. I want to see Adam Brody in more things. We will talk more about like what happens to him in this movie. I like all the kids. I the one girl who is the youngest one, right? The young kid who, as an adult, has to play as a young kid, I think is always funny to me. And I think the actress does a great job with that, too. So the set pieces are fun. It's really funny at times. Like, there are some great gags in this movie that I laughed at. And, yeah, I had a good time with it. It's not the first Shazam. It can never be the first time. But I think revisiting this universe really made me glad, you know, that we got to see all these folks again. I want to see more of this family for sure.
Would not have guessed Devendra would be pretty okay with Shazam Fury of the Gods. But I'm glad you liked it. Had a good time, Devendra. And speaking of hashtag family, Chris Morgan is one of the writers on this movie. He also has produced and written several Fast and Furious movies, if I'm not mistaken.
Funny that there is a Fast and Furious reference right in front of Helen Mirren. But yeah.
Yes. Yeah. The actress who plays Magdalene Shaw in Deckard Shaw's mom in the Fast and Furious movie. It's a weird, weird situation.
Very weird.
Anyway, Jeff, hopefully I didn't step on your limerick there. What do you think about Shazam Fury of the Gods?
Five lines about Magdalene Shaw. The garbage now.
I have so many poems that I could tell Amir and come on.
What I think about Shazam Fury of the Gods is best summed up in the form of this limerick.
Mm.
I think I liked the first Shazam, but the sequel's so bad, I'm like, damn.
Wow.
Why did they repeat it? I'd like to delete it. The equivalent of movie spam.
Wow.
Jeez.
This movie had me second guessing my like of the first movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same creative team, and I'm like, am I remembering that right? Did I actually enjoy that movie? Have I been holding that up as one of the highlights of the DC?
You had the surprise. You had the surprise of the first movie, right?
I guess. I just feel like nothing in this movie works for me. I was not on this movie's wavelength at any point. And I have, I want to step back for a second. I want to say, first thing I thought when I watched this is, so recently watched Shazam Fury of the Gods, Creed 3,
yep.
Scream 6,
Ant-Man.
I just watched John Wick 4,
yeah.
Ant-Man and the Wasp,
jeez.
Magic Mike's Last Dance, right? Yep. In all of those situations, I realize now in all of those situations, and it struck me most acutely starting Shazam Fury of the Gods. In all of those situations, I was like, what happened last time?
What happened?
We really I'm need a previous.
Yeah,
like,
there's no I previously there's no previous.
On.
There should be a well, previously
that's
on.
Need to do
yeah.
it.
That's yes. my point. Is yeah. television shows do a previously on, but for some reason movies uh-huh. are above that. Like that is beneath a film to actually. But why? Why? It's a courtesy to the audience.
We need it.
Television shows do like the fact that Succession. Is not above telling you a previously on, you know? And I'm sorry, Shazam, Fury of the Gods, you are no Succession. But I feel like at this point with movie sequelitis and the, you know, and believe me, I know, you know, Marvel has done this worse than anybody, but I think at this point, like, I have too many franchises in my head. I'm excited to go into Creed 3. I'm excited to start John Wick 4. I'm excited for all these movies. But when I sit down, I'm like, wow, they're really expecting me to have recently caught up, really know where we left the story off, you know? Anyway, so I, like I said, this movie, I should maybe have gone back and rewatched Shazam before watching this. I felt like it was recent enough that I'd remember it, but it definitely made me start doubting the fact that I liked that movie because this, I'm going to have almost all of the same problems that I had with Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania. I feel mm-hmm. like these two movies are the poster children for comic book movie pablum. You know, it is exactly what's wrong with comic book movies right now. Like nothing in this movie. I really wish I'd seen the movie that Devendra saw because I was listening to him describe it. And I was like, I wish I thought all those things. I felt like none of this movie had weight. None of the characters had anything they cared about. I have no idea what the villains are doing in this movie at all. Everybody feels like they're playing dress up. No one feels like they're in an actual place at any time ever. It's a nothing burger. It's a complete nothing burger. And like Ant-Man and the Wasp, in that review, I said the same thing in that it's a competent movie. It's not a incompetent movie. It holds together structurally. It doesn't insult my intelligence particularly. And so in that sense, I kind of agree with Devendra that it's fine, but like, it's not, it is so forgettable. And so, like I said, it's like spam. I just delete it from my mind instantly. And it makes me think like, was the first one that, but the first one was fun. I have some specific problems with this. One of them is there is a sort of teen romance that happens at the beginning of this movie that makes absolutely no sense. The girl likes the boy for no reason whatsoever. And then as we continue to learn more about the girl, it makes less and less sense that that happens at all. Mm-hmm. It's trite. It is badly written. It's poorly executed. My biggest like personal pet peeve about this movie, and I don't remember if I had it in the first movie, I may have, but it just may have been so fun that I didn't care. My biggest pet peeve with this movie is that Zachary Levi is doing this really fun, irreverent, jokey, young kid in an adult body, like big as a superhero thing. But the kid isn't. The kid who plays Billy Batson isn't doing any of the stuff that Zachary
he's
Levi
not doing
is doing.
Anything. He's not doing anything, to be honest. He's a snore.
He's barely in the movie. But yeah.
But Zachary Levi is playing a young kid, and the young kid is trying to play an adult. And there's no point that I believe that that young kid behaves at any point like Zachary Levi is behaving in this movie. Because we never see him do anything like that.
He's never joking. Freddie Freeman, Jack Dylan Grazer, has that vibe. Like he is a kid.
Yes.
He has the vibe.
Shazam.
He should have been the star.
Yes.
He should have been Shazam.
Yes. Zachary Levi is doing that that gag.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the kid is like, you know, wacky, quippy,
he's
and
like
fun.
Goofy. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It makes at no point do I like the fun of Big or these kinds of movies is like, oh my gosh, the adult actor is playing a kid in an adult body. And I think Zachary Levi is 100% doing that. But that kid does, it's not that kid he's playing. He's playing some other kid.
Yeah. This kid is a snooze. It's such a snooze.
And the whole movie's a snooze. Like, dude, I could not wait for this movie to end. It's a nothing burger. And there's this like all of this God stuff that is it just feels like someone threw something at a wall. It's like, oh, look, all of the God stuff that you've ever heard of is in the movie for some reason. What is Lucy Liu doing in this movie? I just thought this movie was
so you don't like it,
forgettable.
You don't like it.
So, but it's like, it's not
TLDR.
It's not like you said, it's fine, but like, that's just not good enough for the effort, the talent, the money that was brought to bear on this. Like what are we doing?
You know what? I will reassess my statement. I will say it's more than fine. I will say it's
well, wow.
So just to have a clear demarcation.
I'm surprised that Devendra being so positive. Like, okay. So, Ryan Broderick, internet journalist, who I enjoy his work greatly over at the Garbage Day newsletter. He had a mega viral tweet recently where he said, the Captain America First Avenger, right? The post-credit scene, I think it's the post-credit scene, right? Where, so I'm going to spoil the post-credit scene of Captain America First Avenger. He wakes up in some facility. And then he, like, hears a baseball game on the radio. And then he's like, hey, I know, that baseball game's not real because I was there. So that can't be an actual baseball game. And then he realizes he's actually been cryogenically frozen until he's in the future. And he busts out and he's in Times Square or whatever. You know, like, it's actually great.
That's the final scene. That's not the post-credit scene, I believe. It's one of the
final scene, mid credit scene. You might be right. It's the final scene. Anyway,
because you end on the shot of him in Times Square.
So, yeah. Okay. You're right about that. But anyway, he was saying how basically that scene is notable because it's one of the last times he can remember where a Marvel character reacted to a physical object in a room.
Yes.
In many Marvel films, it's like they're not even in the space that they're in. And so, the fact that he's in an actual room and there's a physical object in the room
he runs through a set.
He's walking through a set. He's reacting to it. Like, that's notable, you know? And I do think that we get a lot of that kind of vibe, certainly with Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania, where it felt like,
at no point
do I believe any of these characters are in any of these spaces, right?
The chair they are sitting on doesn't exist. It's all make-believe.
Now, I think this movie does suffer a little bit from that, but it's not as bad as Quantumania, in my opinion. But it's still pretty rough. There's many scenes where it's like, I don't actually believe this is a real space. It doesn't look real. And that is a big problem. Now, I actually, as you know, I'm going to try to take the middle line between the two of you and say it was fine. I think that per what Jeff's saying, like, it does feel weightless. It does feel like super heavy CG. But there are some pretty cool things in the movie that I don't think Jeff Cannata is giving it credit for. Okay, let me throw a few things out there. First of all, what I love about David Sandberg movies is, as you mentioned, Devendra, he comes from a horror director background.
Yeah. He can't help but be
creepy. There's always going to be some really effed up stuff in the movie. There's always going to be stuff that's like really upsetting in the movie. And so there's a bunch of those things in this movie. So as an example, the movie opens and you discover like what Lucy Liu and Helen Mirren play these gods in the movie, right? And the movie opens and you kind of learn very quickly that they have the ability to like whisper into someone's ear, and then like the person's eyes will become like
truly
and cloudy,
truly
and then they'll become like a different human.
Certainly, that's something they could have used more times than twice.
That is a really cool concept, though, right? Like, I just love that
goes
idea.
Nowhere. Goes absolutely nowhere.
Sure, but it's executed pretty well, and they use it a few times, Jeff. They don't use it just twice, but you know.
Yeah, they use it a few times. Yeah, and I think that whole opening sequence, a couple of times.
The opening sequence is cool
about things. Yeah. They try to compel one character, and his force of will is so strong, they can't.
Yeah. And there's a bunch of, like, I think in general, like the design of many of the creatures is pretty cool. And there's a kind of Harry Potter version of Microsoft Clippy in this movie.
Thing I want to say about that.
Okay. Let's wait to spoilers.
If that's a spoiler.
Let's wait to spoilers. But I guess there's enough cool things in the movie that I'm like, oh, I could see how kind of potentially, based on the first movie, there's like some horrifying, I think it was like the seven sins in the first movie, right?
Yep.
And those are like pretty freaking horrifying things as rendered in the first film. And I feel like there's enough of those kinds of things in the second movie that I'm like, all right, there's enough like meat here that I appreciate kind of what David Sandberg is trying to do. And I think that if I had watched this movie as a kid, I would be like, oh, that's a great continuation of the Shazam story.
This is very much, I think, directly a kid's movie compared to the first movie.
Right. I think where the movie does fall down is the first movie really had a heart with the Billy Batson story that this one's missing. It tries to kind of fill that in with this kind of Billy Batson's relationship to his family. Doesn't work because Billy Batson is in the movie for about 7 minutes.
And also Billy Batson sucks. Like the actor, as we have all said, like Asher Angel, sorry, buddy, but...
Well, it's not even the actor. Something. I think it's like, I don't know why that performance is the way it is, but probably it may be like there's some mismatch between what Zachary Levi is trying to do and what Asher Angel is trying to bring to the role. But anyway, they try to fill it in with like Billy Batson's relationship to his adopted family. Doesn't quite work. That said, there are some cool elements to the ending that I really enjoyed. Mm-hmm. And some elements that were not great, and we'll talk about those in a little bit. But so basically, real mixed bag, definitely approaching Quantumania levels of roughness, but not quite as bad as Quantumania, in my opinion. So I do think it's significantly better than what Jeff gives it credit for. So those are my thoughts. But why don't we get to spoilers, guys, because there's a bunch of things to discuss, okay? So spoilers for Shazam! Fury of the Gods, starting right now.
I've thought up an ending for my book.
It makes no damn sense.
Compels me, though.
I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end.
When I buy a new book, I always read the last page first. That way, in case I die before I finish, I know how it ends.
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
I came here to tell you how it's going to begin.
All right. We are in spoilers for Shazam! Fury of the Gods. So I liked little pen guy. Steve, I think.
Little pen guy rules. Yes, Steve.
No.
That's a pretty cool
It's funny.
Design.
Pretty cool. It's funny to me that the notion of this magical thing where you can ask it to summarize a story for you, and it's ChatGPT, you guys. We have that right now. You don't need a magical pen. You literally, everything the magical pen does in this movie.
Can ChatGPT send a message with paper to anybody whose name you whisper, Jeff?
I believe they call it email. No. Email, Devendra. It's called email.
Jeff, email Jeff, in the Forgotten Realm.
What is where is the childlike wonder? In
you're like no wonder.
The Jeff Cannata, yeah. You're like a freaking old man, dude. Like
I'm an
it's
old
a
man. I don't know if you're aware of that.
It's a fucking it's a pen that takes it's dictation, dude.
Like, I'm telling
it
you,
can animate itself and do things like
everything
dude,
that
odds,
it does.
That is
it,
objectively
that it
a
does.
Cool idea.
Yeah, I just the.
Objectively,
it has a personality.
Go ahead, Jeff. Go ahead.
I'm just trying to say that I thought it was funny that they're like, "Wow, we have this magical thing where we can ask it, what are all the Greek bad guys, and who are all the Greek gods?" I'm like, "You can, Bing does that right now, right now. You like don't need a magical pen; it will do exactly
Microsoft
what the magical pen."
I'm losing my mind. Like, it's just like this is such a weird. First of all, this movie was made before ChatGPT was released.
Yeah, yeah.
And
but
secondly,
also, the internet does not have this full history of what's going on in this magical realm.
It didn't come out before it was released. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
The weird.
If I made a movie,
I'm getting up.
Like,
oh,
Jeff's magical pen.
What is going on? Anymore?
This is how the film cast ends over a magical pen in a Shazam movie.
I just threw my headphones down and got up off the chair just now because I'm like, I have no idea what's even happening.
We've 10 plus years. It's all over from the ChatGPT pen.
I think what we've learned is Jeff has a secret screenplay for Shazam 3. And Jeff is just going to shit on any other Shazams.
ChatGPT wrote it for me, and I was really, really ready to make it work.
I mean, why not even Google? Okay, whatever.
What? Google what?
I'm just saying, you could also say Google does a similar thing. You
well,
know?
He it said Bing does it because any
well,
search
Bing has
engine can get you something.
But anyway, okay. Enough
that's why
chat.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of Bing, Dave. I'm just saying, I think it's funny.
Did a big
I think it's
out.
Funny. Yeah. It's not, I don't even think it's a flaw of the movie. I just thought it was very funny to me. It's like if you're in a fantasy world and, you know, someone in the world has a magical solution for something that literally everybody can do already. That's the thing that's funny to me.
Okay, but the part of the thing that's fantastical is not asking a thing and getting answers. It's the fact that it's a pen that can write things of its own volition and can fly around.
The pen like has a personality.
It has a personality using like one little string of things. That's a cool design. That's a cool character design.
The joke is that it's very literal. It will record everything you say. And I think that was hilarious.
My biggest laugh of the movie.
We've all had that experience when dictating into the phone.
Yes. My biggest laugh of the movie was when Helen Mirren is reading off like
The whole
thing. That was awesome. Great moment.
Only laugh of the movie, but yes.
Okay. All right.
Anyway, that's not the biggest issue with the whole film.
Oh, really, Jeff? Because it sounds like we just spent 5 minutes talking about it.
It's because you guys were so offended that I would insult your favorite friend, Steve the
Pan.
No,
not that you insulted, but that you would say it's because of ChatGPT that it's invalid. Okay. All right. We have to move on. Okay. So I do think that the ending could have been pretty cool. Like, if they hadn't had the Gal... So, spoilers for the movie, but... And it's given away in the TV spot. Gal Gadot shows up, and for no reason.
No reason.
Kind of revives Shazam back from the dead. Okay, but, like, imagine if that scene didn't happen, right? Like, if that had been where Shazam had died. That would have been cool.
Like, if they kill this character off, that's amazing.
It's actually like poignant when he's like saying goodbye to his family and like, and then he's like, I'm going to sacrifice myself. And it's like, yes, this is what the true heart of a warrior is. Like, they did a pretty good job setting up the Philadelphia Dome, which is there for some reason, you know, like, it's like, oh yeah, it's all the pieces are there for him to give his life. I thought that could have been cool. And then of course they completely undo it.
I mean, come on. This is, you give a horror director a dead body and like a fresh pile of dirt. He's just waiting. He's just waiting for the shot, for the hand to come out of the dirt. You know it.
Yeah. I mean, at least have it be a post-credits scene, though. I don't know.
I don't know.
Because it wasn't post-credits in this case. Also, it is wild to think that this is the last we're ever going to see of Gal Gadot's version of Wonder Woman. Do you realize that?
Is that true?
I mean, I don't know.
There is no other confirmed project in which she is in right now. So
that could change.
That could change. At this point, it is very possible. Like, there's no active development on Wonder Woman 3, as far as I understand. So, like,
that's why I feel like this cameo empty, completely empty.
This could
very well
be the end for Wonder Woman, which is like pretty shameful. Like, that character deserves a better ending than this.
Yeah. It's connective tissue to nothing. It's the weirdest thing. It's like I said when we started recording. Nobody told this movie that the rest of the DCU is changing. You know, this
movie's like, oh, power.
And then the actual post credit scene is like, we're making the Justice Society. It's like, no, you're not. No, you're not. No, maybe they
could. Those are the characters from what's that other show? So
Peacemaker.
None of that.
I do love shout out to Mr. Mind, who returns again in the final post credit scene. That was fun. That's a lot of fun.
I just like how Jeff Cannata, in any other movie would be freaking out. Guys, there's people from the TV show in the movie. Oh, I can't believe we live in a world where you can have TV show characters in a movie. And it's like,
if it actually meant anything, because
we don't know.
Literally a guy stood in front of a lectern and was like, everything's changing. I'm changing everything.
Don't talk to, the mic won't pick it up if you scream too loud into it. It won't. Sometimes it'll like clip out.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm just saying he stood in front of the lectern and he was like, he literally, before the movie comes out, is like, we're wiping the slate clean. And then this movie is like, oh no, we got all this connective tissue.
I don't know. Things change. I don't understand. Last week, that guy was not directing Superman. Now he is.
Now his wife is in the post-credit scene of Shazam Fury of the Gods.
Oh, is that his wife? Huh,
yeah, that's sweet. His wife.
Let's move past the Mr. Mind thing.
Do you think James Gunn would put his wife in a post-credit scene that he's not going to pay off,
in a movie like Jenna Fisher in Slither?
I don't think so.
Did you guys see the final after-credit scene, by the way?
I did not.
Okay, so
I got the hell out of
The return of Mark Strong!
Yeah.
And so Mr. Mind.
At the end of Shazam 1, Mr. Mind shows up in Mark Strong's prison and is like, hey,
voiced by David Sandberg, by the way.
Together we can team up and rule the world. You know, like, that's kind of what he says.
This will be paid off in the second movie, they said.
They did. They paid it off.
In the post-credit
scene. You should have stuck around, Jeff.
Post-credit scene.
You should have stuck around.
Okay.
Because one of the best jokes of the movie is Mr. Mind has this, like, grand plan. He's like, I have little legs. I have to scurry everywhere. It takes me a while to get this plan together. That killed me.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, other things.
Kudos. That's great. Wonderful.
Other things I like about the movie, I liked, like, the idea of these creatures from mythology, like, visiting Philadelphia and just completely killing everyone. Like, again, like, just it feels like Sandberg's horror movie roots informing this movie in a fun and scary and terrifying way. Like, if I had watched Shazam 1 or 2 as a kid, I would be having nightmares about those movies, in my opinion.
Shazam 1 has a murder room sequence. You forget that? Like, where people in a conference room are murdered.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, that's the most horrifying scene in that movie. Yeah. And and this you know, movie also has, like, you know, those things rampage around. Love the take on the unicorn, you know, like, as like the most horrifying.
Jimon Hansu talking about the unicorn as the most terrifying creature in mythology.
I think that's funny
that
concept.
It's funny.
Way better if the unicorn doesn't look like a nightmare, you know? If it literally is the pristine, beautiful white rainbow thing, and it's still horrible, way better.
That's one way of doing it, Jeff.
It's a better way
of
doing it.
If this was Jeff's Shazam movie, it would be a beautiful unicorn.
How awful was that product placement, though?
Man, but
that was very weird.
It was hilarious.
It was weird.
Taste the rainbow, motherfucker.
But see, that is a funny line. That is a funny line. Unfortunately,
you gotta set it up, Jeff.
No, you don't.
You don't have to see this.
You don't have to set it up by saying "taste the rainbow" the first time, and then "taste the rainbow, motherfucker." You ruined the joke of saying "taste the rainbow" by saying "taste the rainbow" the first time. Having them literally 30 seconds apart.
It may have been contractual to have a good "taste the rainbow."
Yeah, that's the problem.
I assume that was probably
the problem.
The payoff was worth it. I think the payoff was worth it, personally.
Oh, also, the other thing that I like about this, you know, I'm just trying to point out some things I enjoy about the movie, Jeff. But I like kind of Rachel Zegler's powers of, like, rearranging things. Like, at first
That was cool.
I was kind of confused. It's like, is she actually rearranging things, or is she just... here's another, by the way,
that
red
character
horror
makes
movie
no
thing.
Sense at all, though.
Okay, I will get into it. I want to hear your thoughts on that. But I want to say, speaking of David Sandberg's horror movie roots, I like that he just straight up had Dietrich Bader's character kill himself for absolutely no reason.
Poor,
like,
Dietrich Bader.
Dietrich Bader
needs more work, man.
Dietrich Bader walks up onto the roof, and he literally, like, commits suicide. And it's like... Yep. That's never referenced again for the rest of the movie.
Yeah,
it's like
it's scary too.
It's disturbing the way he does it.
And they talk about how he bursts like a grape. It's like,
I was like,
don't put that image in kids' heads.
That's the thing, is like I like that. I when I watched the first Shazam, I was like, ooh, these tones are really clashing. But now I'm just like, you know what?
Yeah.
I am grateful for any superhero film that can make me feel horror. You know, like, I'm
anything.
You hated Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness.
Hate's too strong of a word, but yeah.
Well, weren't grateful for it, like you just said. I'm grateful for any.
I like Sam Raimi. Like, there's very Sam Raimi stuff in that movie. Those Sam Raimi stuff I really liked in that movie. So anyway, and probably my expectations were a little bit higher for that one than this. I'm going to put that out there as well.
Mm-hmm.
What about Helen Mirren's weird 180 degree flip for no reason at all in this movie?
Yeah, I can't.
Reason at all.
I can't defend, it's not no reason at all, Jeff. Like, she's clearly worried about Lucy Liu's character being completely drunk with power and betraying their original mission. But I will grant you that it is not exactly the most well-laid track for this movie to
pay
off.
And also, maybe, I think Helen Mirren was kind of the weak link here. Because I look at Helen Mirren in that armor, and I do not feel fear. As threatening as she tries to be. Lucy Liu, I feel fear. You know, like, I feel like that was perhaps a miscast there.
Mm. All right.
Both of them feel like they're... in a weird, like, the weird costumes that don't fit them in weird sets that they're not actually on. Both of them just, I'm like, you both have so much talent. Like, why are we doing this? Ugh.
So, Jeff, the Rachel Zegler character didn't work for you.
No.
And it seems like you had stuff you wanted to say about that, so I want to give you that opportunity.
She shows up, immediately falls in love with our main character kid for no reason at all. No reason at all. And stays true and faithful to him for no reason at all. It makes even less sense when we realize she's 6,000 years old. And we have characters who comment on how that's icky, but like, yes, that it's not okay to just acknowledge the weird thing in your movie. That doesn't make it go away. It's super icky. Like, why does she like that kid?
Hey, Jeff, remind me to never show you the Twilight movies, okay? Remind me never to show you the billion-dollar grossing franchise, the Twilight movies, okay?
No, you're right, because the Twilight movies are a defense of literally anything.
Oh, yeah.
Hot garbage.
Yeah. But let's be clear, like, she had, like, a plan to... Not to like seduce him.
It's literally
anything,
a reverse.
She was trying to be a friend. Yeah.
Yes,
early
Jeff,
on.
It's a reverse. She's
it is
all
a
that.
Setup.
It's a reverse. She's all
yeah.
that. Okay.
Yeah.
It kind of. Couldn't
she's
deny.
Going in there to try to get close to this family who she suspects. Mm-hmm. You know, they all know that he's superheroes because she needs to get superheroes. But then at the end of the day, she's like, you know, when I took this bet, you know, I didn't know that I would actually fall in love.
Yes.
It's a reverse.
Literally what it is.
With a boy that's 5,980 years younger than her.
Oh, you're big on math.
Hey, yeah, Jeff, never watch any vampire movies. Jeff, never watch any vampire movies, okay? Never watch any movies where, or superhero movies for that example. Like, never watch Wonder Woman, Jeff, okay? Because Wonder Woman's fucking 400 years older than Steve, you know? What the hell, man?
Never watch an accurate representation of Romeo and Juliet. Juliet's
I am
like, well.
It's losing my mind.
You don't think that it's
right now.
You don't, dude. Tell me, you think that romance makes sense? Is well executed? You believe it? It's the most trite, poorly written.
She,
like
he she is trying to get in his good graces. Like it's not
okay.
meant to be an organic. It's not meant to be an organic romance. I'm
but you just said
now,
that she finds herself in
words.
Love with him. Oh my god.
Yeah, by the at the end, at the end,
at the
she
end.
Does.
It does kind of turn into him because I think that character is interesting because she's clearly like, guys, we don't have to destroy this world. We don't have to go so hard. And I found that just kind of interesting. I liked having different point of views, even from the villain side of things, you know?
Anyway, and that was a cool moment when she like, when Lucy Liu shoots the beam at her and she like rearranges the whole city.
Man.
And then like the beam still is coming at her. That was amazing. I was just like,
that was cool. That was cool. Amazing yes, moment. That was cool.
Okay. Jeff, yes. you've said there's like three things that are good in this movie, okay? Like
there,
so,
yes, there are three effect shots that are very effective. Yes, I'm not. I said the movie was fine, but
no, you
I
didn't.
Think it's Pablum.
No,
I think
you
it's,
didn't.
I said I did over and over. I said I agree
you
with him.
Fine.
The movie's
yeah.
fine,
fine,
but like, what are we doing with this?
But then I had
talent?
To reassess my definition of fine after hearing your review, Jeff.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
I think that Ant-Man and the Wasp was like on a certain level fine, but like. It's just that's not good enough.
I agree. It's a missed opportunity to do something a little bit more with these characters. And I think the big sin that the movie commits is it leans too far into the Shazam component of it. Like the first movie was like this balance between Billy Batson and Shazam. Like and that's an interesting concept of like a child. Being a, you know, no other superhero franchise is doing that right now. We're like,
and also
it's
a
children.
Group of kids and trying to wrangle a group of kids together as a superhero team. Impossible.
Well,
I think it's kind of funny how that works.
You do point, you do point to one of my issues with this movie, Devendra, which is that
kids,
you
know, kids.
Which is that Helen Mirren and Lucy Liu are like, you kids shouldn't have this awesome godlike power. And I'm like, I gotta agree with the villains there. I don't feel like giving children, giving What's a child the ability to nuke a city. Mm. Is a great? Would you give children nuclear weapons?
I
you
mean,
know, like...
that sounds like we're rewriting history here because the only reason they got the powers was to like defeat the guy who was trying to destroy the city and the world.
No,
so,
no, but okay, yeah. but that is over.
That's
and
over.
Now you can
now,
you know
hand, now you want to take the powers back?
Hand Daddy back the nuclear weapons. It's to hand them over, baby. Come on, you can do it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, I think that first sequence where they, first of all, they have the code word to assemble as a team. kind of hilarious because they're trying to do it like under the nose of their parents, and the slow like awareness of the parents too to everything. I find that all funny. It's just funny. I like the parents too because they seem very sweet and they like these adopted kids. That whole bridge sequence, I think, is like a great. I can't imagine any other movie kind of doing it like that, because these are kids in this role. They're not like trained. They're not like fully organized. They're still kids. Like you present them a basket of kittens in a car for some reason. They're going to go after the kittens first. And I think all that, I don't know, it just worked for me as a sequence. And their problems as a family and as a team, again, I feel like there's real character motivation here. One character wants to go off and do her own thing, go to college. You know, the parents are kind of worried about these kids. Like, to me, those all felt like grounded motivations, whereas there was no motivation for anything in Quantumania. Like, that was kind of one thing. It's like, oh, I guess we're in the quantum realm now. Oh, I guess we're on a sci-fi adventure now. At least here, despite all the CG, despite like the mess of it, it feels like rooted in the characters. And that's really all I ask for. You know?
I do think it's a step up from Quantumania. I also agree, like, I think the reviews were a little bit too harsh on it. Not that much harsh on it, but a little too harsh on it. But that said, I think my opinion on superhero films in general has changed over time. You guys know Batman v Superman, Batman gives a speech. And Batman's supposed to be the bad guy. You know, he's like...
Yeah.
He's like... This guy, Superman, he can destroy the whole planet. If there's even a 1% chance that might happen, we have to treat it like an absolute certainty. And, you know, I think we're meant to view that as, like, unreasonable. But as I've gotten older, I'm like, yeah, I think that guy's right. Like, no one should have this power. So when I see a girl, like, being like, ooh, kittens, I'm going to take those instead of saving your life, I am terrified. I'm like,
yeah.
The implications of children having this power are terrifying to be. Terrifying. Like, I think we're supposed to, as the audience, we're supposed to be like, tee hee, that's funny. And when I watch it, I'm like, Helen Mirren and Lucy Liu have a point. That's kind of my reaction to this.
You've gone full Zack Snyder now, Dave.
100%.
That is the Zack Snyder position. Is that
100%? Yes. I mean, Kevin Costner in Man of Steel. I'd rather die than have you use your powers.
Yeah.
Basically,
yeah. These characters are a priori terrifying. They're just like, on the face of it, the notion of a Superman is a horrific 100%. Notion. Yeah.
I remember there's a scene in the Amazon Prime Video series Invincible, where what's the main guy's name? The J.K. Simmons character. He like goes to this other planet. There's this other planet that's like invading Earth, and he like goes to the other planet, and then he just like flies around like a thousand times, like back and
destroys
forth,
the civilization.
Just completely annihilates the planet because he can pass through anything. And it's just like, wow, like it's true. Superman could literally destroy the entire planet in like about 10 minutes if he wanted to.
Right.
Sure.
Yeah. Basically, I'm saying
you've arrived
scare me.
You've arrived at 1990s.
I hope they burn in hell. Okay, go ahead. Sorry,
you've arrived at the 1990s postmodern superhero phenomenon.
I'm finally where we were 30 years ago. That's right.
That's right. The entire X-Men plot line of rounding up kids, sending them to Genosha. That's where you are now. You're a striker. You're Colonel Striker.
Picture me giving Senate testimony during an X-Men movie. Okay, that's what you should do. All right. Any other thoughts on Shazam: Fury of the Gods?
No. I'm glad we got to talk about it. This review went places I did not expect. So that was fun.
Yeah, I understand that Jeff Cannata hates joy, hates delight. You know, that thing.
I search for delight. I seek it out. I want to find it. I ask for more than just fine. I want. Mm-hmm. Like we're at the point now where we've gotten all of this abundance of riches and we don't need to just have another one, you know? And I know, listen, I understand how that sounds hilarious and hypocritical from somebody that is a huge fan of the Marvel films. But listen, I've turned on the Marvel films too, because we can't just keep doing this, folks. We can't.
We're not one Marvel film, Jeff. To be clear, one.
Did you like Wakanda almost Forever? 30. Did you like Wakanda Forever? I
thought Wakanda Forever was not great. I thought it was not great. I think there are great moments in it. I think there are great themes in it. But I thought it was overstuffed. And I think I said there's just like it's unwieldy and not great. And what was the one before that? I don't think I would give a review of.
I think that was Multiverse of Madness.
That was Multiverse.
I like that one. I like that one a lot. Mm-hmm. So, anyway,
but yes.
This is a problem is that it feels like these things are sort of just moving of their own accord instead of and I mean, what I loved about the phase one, phase two, phase three of the Marvel stuff is that it felt like it was all building to something, and that felt special. I'm also going to put this out there.
I have not seen John Wick Chapter 4, but I have heard it is one of the greatest feats of action filmmaking in the history of mankind.
Cannot wait.
That's what I said.
And my guess is your viewing of Shazam Fury of the Gods was not served by you seeing
like
that
one
movie
day after you saw John Wick, right?
It was literally the day after. It was literally the day after. And yes.
That'd be rough. That'd be rough come down, probably. I can imagine that. Yeah.
Well, anyway.
Well, at the end of the day.
I don't want to say anything about John Wick 4 right now because we will be talking about John Wick 4.
But at the end of the day, it still is really impressive that David Sandberg made a movie. And with that, I think we can wrap up the filmcast for today. You can find more episodes of this podcast at thefilmcast.com. Email us at /filmcast@gmail.com. A huge thanks to Noah Ross for providing our weekly plugs music as well as our spoiler bumper, and also Tim McEwen from The Midnight and Varsity Blue for providing our theme song. This episode was edited by me, David Chen. Video editing provided by Kurt Mega and John Barry. And you can always support us at patreon.com/filmpodcast. Email us at /filmcast@gmail.com. Okay, I think that's everything. Next week, it is going to be John Wick Chapter 4. Now, I'm going to be honest, guys. My patience with the John Wick franchise was pretty much at an end from a story perspective after John Wick Chapter 3. But the things I'm hearing about Chapter 4, man, get me super excited. Yeah,
well, so, also, really, two words, Donnie Yen.
Don't get excited about story perspective, Dave. That's all I'm saying.
This set better have the best story I've ever seen in a movie.
It is 3 hours long, which is something I did not realize until I literally sat down. I told my wife, "Oh, honey, don't worry, I'll be home by 10, and I'll be home by like 9:30." And then I realized, "Oh no, 11 o'clock is when we're getting out of this movie."
I can't wait to watch the movie, discuss it with the folks here on the Filmcast. So stay tuned for that next week. Until then, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you later.